Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The court would like to welcome this morning students from Sully Buttes High School and also the paralegal students from Western Dakota Technical School. We have a couple of publications available. I think they're right outside the door. One is a narrative on how the judicial system works in South Dakota. The second is a pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. So help yourself after you have completed listening to this term of court. The first case for oral argument this morning is Keila O'Farrell and Corey O'Farrell, appellants versus Rusty Jensen, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Larry Von Wald, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Mr. John Knight, an attorney from Clear Lake. Mr. Von Wald, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Your Honors, the issue on appeal in this case is whether a trial court may properly admit in evidence the report of a law enforcement officer without that officer testifying and being subject to cross-examination. It arises in the context of an altercation that took place in a bar in Marvin, South Dakota on July 31 of 2004. During the late evening hours, the plaintiff, in this case, Rusty Johnson, came to the bar with his girlfriend and several other friends. They were out partying in celebration of a birthday. They had been first at the bar in the old Gunslinger's Bar down in Twin Brooks, South Dakota. They'd been then gone to the Summit Bar in Summit, South Dakota, and ultimately arrived at the Marvin Bar in Marvin, South Dakota. The Marvin Bar was owned by Keila O'Farrell, and her husband was present in the bar and was an employee. After Mr. Johnson and his group arrived at the bar, he was served by Keila O'Farrell, and then a few moments later, she told him that she would like him to leave. And the background behind that was that there had been personal and business relationships between defendant Keila O'Farrell and Mr. Johnson that had gone bad, and that there were bad feelings that had been developed that were known to both of them. Shortly after Mr. Johnson was asked to leave the bar by defendant Keila O'Farrell, her husband Corey O'Farrell asked Mr. Johnson to step outside the bar to have a word with him, and Mr. Johnson joined him outside the bar, at which time Corey O'Farrell told Mr. Johnson, he said, "You're not welcome here, and we'd like you and your friends to leave." The testimony was that Mr. O'Farrell was polite, and Mr. Johnson responded by saying, "Thanks, buddy, I know we shouldn't be here, and we're going to leave." Mr. Johnson went back into the bar, and when his girlfriend came out of the ladies' room, he told her that they had to leave. And at that point, the testimony among the parties begins to differ sharply.
Does it make any difference on your argument which version of the facts is believed?
Well, Your Honor,
as far as the admissibility of the report.
No, it doesn't make any difference about the admissibility of the report, but in this particular context, Your Honor, the testimony between the parties as to what happened was sharply divergent, and in this particular instance, the report became pivotal in the jury's consideration of the issue. On the one hand, Mr. Johnson and his girlfriend testified that Corey O'Farrell unprovoked got up off of a bar stool and tackled Mr. Johnson, causing him to go into a wall and break his wrist and his ankle. Corey O'Farrell's testimony and Keila O'Farrell's testimony was considerably different. They testified that Mr. Johnson's girlfriend, upset because they were asked to leave the bar, walked down to the end of the bar where Mr. O'Farrell was sitting and began using loud language, profane language, and got close to Mr. O'Farrell, at which time Rusty Johnson came, got behind Mr. O'Farrell. Mr. O'Farrell stood up out of concern with Mr. Johnson behind him. Mr. Johnson grabbed Mr. O'Farrell by the shirt, which time Corey O'Farrell threw him off. Mr. Johnson stumbled, fell against the wall, and was injured. The testimony was that he was, by his girlfriend, was that he was had been drinking heavily and was highly intoxicated. Sharply divergent testimony for the jury. And then after the plaintiff testified, called his girlfriend to the stand, the next witness he called was the sheriff of Grant County. And the sheriff of Grant County had with him an investigative report that he had not authored. The evidence was offered. It was trial exhibit C, at which time we were allowed to voir dire the witness. The trial court allowed us to voir dire the witness for purpose of a foundation. And the sheriff testified that he couldn't verify that the material in that investigative report was accurate. He couldn't verify that it was complete. The sheriff testified that the deputy that conducted the investigation was no longer there, that he'd interviewed plaintiff Rusty Johnson, but that one interview wasn't even available, and that the report was incomplete.
And the report wasn't a verbatim statement by your clients. It was simply a summary of what the deputy recalled them saying.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
Had your clients ever seen the report before trial? Did they get to read it, to sign it, or anything, or was it the first time they knew of it?
Well, it was not any report that they affirmed by either signing it or acknowledging in any way. Obviously, we knew of the report, of course.
But it wasn't like a police statement where you write out what happened if you're a witness and sign your name.
That's exactly right. It was simply the deputy's recounting of his version of events after he had come to the bar and found that Rusty Johnson had been taken away in an ambulance, and Mr. O'Farrell was there. In fact, in his report, if you read the report, you can see that then he said the victim was taken away. He came and he found that one person was injured and one person remained, and we believe he concluded who the victim was. He put on the report in the letters S for subject, Corey O'Farrell, V for victim, Rusty Johnson. And ultimately, the jury got to see this. But what happened was, is after the sheriff had been voir dire, the trial court allowed counsel the opportunity to ask further questions for purposes of foundation. The court sustained the objection to the report on the grounds of hearsay and foundation, and then allowed counsel to ask further questions. And interestingly, when we were allowed to voir dire, or excuse me, to ask this,
the trial court, though, at that point, There was apparently a conversation at the bench, because the trial court said that for the reasons explained at the bench conference, we don't know what those are, it's not in the record, that it might be admissible later on.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And he said it may be, he was denying the admissibility, but say it may become admissible later on. The trial court did not explain itself when it made those comments. But it did allow the additional questions. And then when those additional questions of the sheriff were asked, the sheriff, seemingly understanding the circumstances there, recognizing that the report, the admissibility had been denied while he was still on the bench, and then the testimony began changed. It was in sharp contrast to what he'd given earlier. He then testified that even though he testified earlier, he had not spoken with the deputy who wrote the report. He said he recalled speaking with the deputy after that investigation. And he gratuitously offered, "I believe what's in this report is true." O'Farrells put on their case. And during the cross-examination of defendant Corey O'Farrell, a counsel for the plaintiff offered Exhibit C once again. And at this time, it was admitted. And when the trial court admitted it, the evidence commented that it was admissible under the teaching of State versus Bainman. And I respectfully submit to the trial judge had confused, and I say that respectfully, of course, had confused the teaching of State versus Bainman with the circumstances we had there in the courtroom in Grant County during the trial of this case. In State versus Bainman, there was a police report that was admitted, but it was only admitted because the officer who authored that report was in court and subjected to cross-examination. Furthermore, in the State versus Bainman case, the defense counsel had been badgering the witness who was the police officer, with his investigative report and with his statement, trying to develop inconsistencies between the officer's testimony at trial and the statements. And he was offering parts of the report and reading it verbatim. And ultimately, the trial court allowed the state to introduce the report, and this court sustained that ruling of the trial court on the basis of the rule of completeness, a common law rule that's codified in 19.9.13.
Let me ask you a question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the trial court was wrong, we have a rule that you're aware of that we apply every day. If the court, even if it stated the wrong reason, if it's admissible for some other purpose, you know, that's not reversible error. This report was actually ultimately admitted during an impeachment of these witnesses. Why wouldn't this be admissible as impeachment evidence under Rule 613? I mean, it's pretty clear from the transcript it was used to impeach these two witnesses because their stories at trial were pretty different from what was reflected in the report.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it would be used for an impeachment. It would be totally unfair to be confronted with the evidence that has not been admitted properly.
Well, you always get impeached by, I mean, it's classic impeachment, isn't it, to use a statement you gave to somebody else that's contrary to your trial testimony?
No, I would submit that it is not. In this particular case, it was exactly the same circumstance that this court addressed in Dubray versus South Dakota Department of Social Services, where a report was admitted without the testimony of the officer. In that case, it would happen to be a report that was authored by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, and this court cited with approval the case of State versus Brown, a case decided by the Supreme Court in the state of Georgia, and spoke of police reports, and particularly the narrative of police reports.
But that was admitted in Dubray as substantive evidence. Why wouldn't it be admissible as impeachment under 613, which is, under that rule, it's not admitted as substantive evidence?
Well, Your Honor, if that were the rule, then in any circumstance we could take the police officer's report without the officer being present and offer it as impeachment. Bring somebody in, like a law enforcement officer who knows nothing about the case, as the sheriff in this case admitted that he hadn't performed any of the investigation, and then offer it as impeachment evidence. Substantial rights of the parties against whom that evidence is offered are going to be affected.
Did the court give a limiting instruction to the effect that this police report was to be considered only for impeachment and no other reason?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you say, was there an instruction?
Did the court give a limiting instruction on that report so that the jury was told that you may consider this for impeachment purposes but not as substantive evidence?
No, Your Honor. And, you know, in terms of impeachment, we're there in the context of a law enforcement officer takes the stand and says, this is what I believed happened. Sitting in a uniform with a badge on his chest and a jury with this divergent testimony, and all of a sudden an official, allegedly official version of an incident is given to them in a piece of evidence.
Mr. Van Wall, going back to your initial statements, though, under if this was admitted as a public record under 8038, the last part of Section 3 states that it is admissible in civil actions, where the case the court relied on was criminal, and this is civil, unless there are circumstances indicating untrustworthiness. What was presented to the court on the untrustworthiness of these records?
Well, I don't think that there. Well, first of all, it was the testimony. The sheriff himself, Your Honor, would suggest that it wasn't trustworthy. But Your Honor, on the issue of trustworthiness, I believe that Dubray versus South Dakota Department of Social Services addresses that issue, and particularly in the context of its. Review of State versus Brown in the state of Georgia. And I think there's comments there that says that, you know, while a police report may meet the indicia of the public or business records exception under 19.16.10, or the public records exception under 1916-13, that it is not approved as one of those exceptions because of the nature of the report, because of the nature of the police report. The Supreme Court of Georgia commented about how police reports are often made by officers who are acting upon an impression, upon a belief, or even a hunch. And they distinguish between a record that's generated and kept in the course of their business, so to speak, with other business records that have on their face are reliable. In this particular case, the sheriff who came to the bar came to investigate a criminal act, simple assault, and identified, as I mentioned earlier, and identified the parties as subject, victim, witness. And so the impact of that was extraordinary. It was the end of the trial. You know, it was so evident at the trial of this case, and my colleague and my friend from Clear Lake knew that as well, because when he gave his summation, that is the first thing that he said to the jury. That's the first thing he brought to the jury. We've got two conflicting stories here about how these injuries took place, and the defendants, O'Farrell, are not telling the truth, and you know because you can take a look at the police report. The evidence was deadly, and the substantial rights were aware that we have to show not only that that this evidence was admitted erroneously, but also that substantial rights were affected. In this particular case,
how much does your argument depend on the fact that the officer that wrote the report was not available for testimony, as opposed to just the report itself?
Well, it centers on that, Your Honor, because it deprives a party, such as the O'Farrells, from cross-examining that officer. It's due process. It's a fundamental fairness. It was a way of introducing the testimony of that officer and insulating him from cross-examination. It would be a preferred way to do things if that were the law. If that were permitted under the law of this state, then a sheriff could come and testify every time his deputies were out investigating, and the problem would be the same. And this is why these O'Farrells have been so aggrieved in this particular case. The standard of review, of course, is the abuse of discretion standard. But again, in DuBray, this court has pointed out that when a court admits evidence in violation of a rule of law, that it does constitute abuse of discretion.
If the sheriff wasn't involved in the investigation at all, was his sole function merely as the record keeper to get this document into evidence? Why was he there?
Well, allegedly, when you review the transcript, of course, Your Honor, you'll see that the examination mirrored what we see when someone is laying foundation for a business record. In other words, you keep this record. Yes, the sheriff commented, and it's kept in his computer. Was he familiar with the investigation? No, he didn't participate in it. He'd heard of it. And he testified he couldn't vouch for the accuracy of the reports that were in his computer. In fact, there was even an exchange where the sheriff, there's a part on the report where it requires the sheriff's approval, and he hadn't even approved the report. The answer was no. And so it was really, in terms of a record, it was really an egregious situation that developed there, all to the detriment of my clients, Kilo Farrell. And
following up on Justice Inner's comment, mm-hmm. you know, that we will affirm if the judge was right for the wrong reason. What about the rule 803 that says that admission by a party opponent is admissible and, in fact, is not hearsay? Does this statement constitute admission by your clients about what happened that night?
Well, again, Your Honor, an admission would only be an admission if the party to whom it was made was there to testify about it. But someone else who has no idea about the case can't come in and then not be subject to cross-examination, say these folks made an admission because I was told they made an admission. I mean, it's the rankest kind of hearsay. It's a type of thing that those of us who who work in the law understand is a fundamental part of due process and fairness in the trial of a case or a hearing. And that's why the law doesn't permit that. And I think that's why this court wisely decided DuBray as it did. And in that particular case, made it very clear that a narrative in a police report is not a business record, cited State versus Bannon, said it is not a public record exception to the hearsay rule. For these reasons, Your Honor, we would respectfully submit this court find that the trial court abused its discretion in admitting the sheriff's report. This case be reversed and remanded to the Third Circuit for a trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wall. Mr. Knight, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justices. Thank you, Counsel. This case is really about the application of Rule 8038 or 19-16-12. We think that that rule clearly provides for the admission of this type of report. The interpretation of DuBray by the defendant's counsel is overly broad. The actual ruling in that case appears very narrow. That is that the state had not provided proper foundation for the admission of those reports as a business record exception. And the rule with respect to 19-16-12, or the holding in DuBray with respect to 19-16-12, is simply that the state, as the proponent, was supposed to introduce some evidence that it was trustworthy. And because they failed to do that, it wasn't admissible. It certainly is not the rule that reports and the narrative of reports are not admissible. 19-16-12 says that reports in any form are admissible as long as there's an indicia of trustworthiness. So it becomes, at that point then, could a judge, in this case Judge Gienap, in view of the law of the circumstances, could another judicial mind have reached the same conclusion? That is, that given the law and the circumstances, is there any way that he could find that this was admissible? Well, I think it's important that you have to look at what the report really was. Really, the only thing that was contained in the report that had anything to do with what was presented at trial was the statements by Keila O'Farrell and by Corey O'Farrell. And those statements were taken at the time by the deputy when he arrived. They acknowledged first that Rusty Johnson and his girlfriend Kim Pinkert weren't even present. So the deputy didn't have a chance to talk to them before he talked to Corey O'Farrell and Keila O'Farrell. Keila was the first person the deputy talked to, and Corey was the second person that the deputy talked to. He reported in his report what they told him.
Well, do we know that for sure if he wasn't there to testify? I mean, doesn't there have to be, with the trustworthiness, somebody to testify that it was trustworthy, that he wrote it down correctly, this was his accurate? I mean, you're almost assuming that every police report then is absolutely accurate in every regard, even without that person who is the scrivener of it is there to testify.
In this particular instance, we do, because Sheriff McKernan testified without objection that he reviewed that with the deputy and confirmed with the deputy that that was in fact what they said, that the report was accurate. So in this particular case, we do have that additional element of reliability.
But here,
go ahead.
I mean, this case is tried in the Grant County Courthouse. I'm assuming the sheriff's office is in the Grant County Courthouse. How tough is it to produce this deputy to provide the foundation that the report was accurate? The author of the report.
Well, the deputy wasn't in Grant County. He didn't live in Grant County anymore. He was no longer a deputy with the Grant County Sheriff's Office. He was unavailable in that regard when he was subpoenaed for the trial.
Well, Mr. Knight, what was there any, I guess, two-part question. Was there any indicia of trustworthiness? What was the indicia of trustworthiness that was made to the report under 803-8? And second, was this really, were these quotes, do we know that? Or I think it was characterized earlier as a summary. And do we know if this is a summary? Can you impeach with a summary? So it's a two-part question, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that they're intended as quotes. It looks to me like they're direct statements. The one made by Corey O'Farrell is that he did throw Rusty against the wall, but he didn't know how he hurt his leg. So in that regard, it's a simple statement taken down by the officer of what the, in this case, the witness or the party said. It certainly is an admission. I think the only issue is, how does it come in? In this case, the judge, when we put on the foundation, and Your Honor, Chief Justice, you asked why the sheriff was called, it's because the defendants wouldn't stipulate the foundation of the report, so we had to call the sheriff for foundation. But the point is that once he came in and testified as the foundation, the judge looked at this and said, how is this relevant? Well, the soliloquy on the bench or the conversation on the bench, I think, involved, at this point, it's not relevant because we don't know how Kilo O'Farrell and Corey O'Farrell are going to testify. But once they testified and they denied that they said those things, then it became relevant for impeachment purposes. And that was essentially what the judge allowed it in for, was impeachment purposes.
Was there a limiting instruction?
There was no limiting instruction.
Was one requested?
It was not requested. And, you know, there's, of course now, having lost the trial, the defendants want to place, I think, undue importance on this particular admission by saying, well, it says on there's an S for subject and a V for victim. There was no discussion of that during the trial. There was no reference to that in the trial.
But the jury did get to see the report. They got to, take it back with them, the report?
It was an exhibit, and presumably it did go back into the jury chambers for them to review.
So it went back then as substantive evidence, not just as impeachment.
Well, that would be true. It came in as impeachment evidence. Whether or not it went back as substantive or impeachment, we don't know. It's certainly true that there was no limiting instruction. But clearly in that context, it was presented as impeachment evidence. It was used as impeachment evidence. And the whole point of it was that they had given a different story to the deputy that night than what they were giving in trial.
Not a statement. I mean, ordinarily we think about a statement. Somebody had, I think of the classic case, you know, to auto accident where someone jumps out and says, oh, that's my fault. I'm sorry. I didn't see you or whatever. That isn't the way this report is presented. This is a narration where it's a summary of, because when you're saying that the defendant said he threw him against the wall, it doesn't say I threw him against the wall. It says he said he threw him against the wall. So it's a narration of someone's statement. Does that make a difference?
I don't think it makes a difference in this instance. The narrative of this report consists of, I talked to Keila O'Farrell, she said this. I talked to Corey O'Farrell, he said this. There's no summary of any facts. There's no indication of what he found when he got at the scene. There's no conclusions about what happened there. It's a simple, parroting of what he says they told him when he got there, and he talked to them. He talked to Kilo O'Farrell, she said this. He talked to Corey O'Farrell, he said this. Those statements happened to contradict what they had said at trial and earlier in their deposition, and it was introduced as impeachment evidence with regard to that. Now,
let me ask you this. If this did incorrectly come in, is it prejudicial error?
If it incorrectly came in, was it prejudicial? It certainly was prejudicial against the defendants.
So then the defendant would get a new trial if we were to find this came in?
I don't think that the defendants are entitled to a new trial under those circumstances, because it really is only prejudicial to the cause of assault. It isn't prejudicial to the cause of action for negligence, and the jury was instructed on negligence. And in that instance, the theory is, did Keila O'Farrell and Corey O'Farrell act reasonably under the circumstances? Was it reasonable for them to serve Rusty Johnson and tell him, drink your one beer and then leave, and then essentially force him out before he had an opportunity to finish his beer? And the testimony in that regard is not contradictive at all. It is very clear that Rusty Johnson did exactly what he was asked to do. He didn't threaten anybody. He didn't talk to anybody. He didn't say anything to Corey O'Farrell. He didn't argue with Keila O'Farrell. He didn't do anything except exactly what he was told to do. When he was asked to leave, he got up to leave. He was in the process of leaving. And during the course of that, he was either pushed or thrown across the bar with such force that he had a broken wrist, a broken ankle, and contusions and cuts to his face. That's the evidence that the jury heard.
Was this a general verdict?
It was a general verdict.
So we don't know what cause of action the jury based its award on.
Exactly. And because of that, they can't claim that they've been prejudiced. The defendants can't claim under those circumstances that they've been prejudiced, because there is ample evidence of negligence to support this verdict, regardless of whether that report was admitted.
So they negligently threw him against the wall, huh?
They negligently removed him from that property, or attempted to, and injured him in the process. Whether they threw him or not, that's the whole point. Doesn't matter what's in that sheriff's report, because it doesn't matter whether they threw him. All they had to do was call law enforcement to get him out. They could have done a number of things. It doesn't matter what they could have done. What they did do was they acted negligently. They owed him a duty of care, and they breached that duty. And he was injured as a result of their negligence, and they're responsible for the damages as a result of that. So under those circumstances, under that theory, they're not prejudiced at all by the introduction of that report. And really, again, that's where I think that when you ask, does it really matter, do the facts really matter with regard to whether this report comes in, they don't. But the facts do matter with respect to that part of that theory that they could have recovered under. And that is that from the outset, the defendant's version of what happened just wasn't credible. It just is not believable that somehow their theory of the case was that Rusty Johnson came to this bar, that he had 12 to 14 beers. He was so intoxicated that somehow when he was leaving, Corey O'Farrell simply touched him on the arm and he stumbled and fell against the wall, resulting in his broken leg, his broken wrist, and these cuts and contusions to his head. The jury didn't buy that. They're never going to buy that. And they shouldn't get a second chance at another jury so they can try and attack this case from another angle. Now, I think that raises another important issue here, and that is, if you would grant the defendants a new trial, what's going to be the effect? Everybody is locked into the same testimony. All of the facts are pretty much established. Ben Cohen's gets called as a witness, he's going to testify to the same things that are in his report.
How do we know that, though?
If he doesn't, the report comes in. If he doesn't testify to those things, then that report is going to come in as impeachment. So we're back to the exact same place, that what is in that report is what he took down that night, and the jury is going to hear that that's what he was told by those witnesses.
Well, it comes in as impeachment, but apparently this came in as substantive evidence in this case. Wasn't there?
Well, I would say there's a technical difference, but I suppose it doesn't matter. I think that really the point is that it comes in either way. The jury gets to hear that that's what they said that night either way.
Well, presumably there'd be a limiting instruction this time.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, there were no errors. I don't know that there was more than one or two proposed instructions. At this two-day jury trial, there was virtually nothing that happened that either side complained about or claimed was error. And this particular report, the fact that the law clearly provides that it should be admissible as long as it's reliable. And I don't necessarily agree that it's our burden to show it's reliable. I think that the case law would indicate that it's their burden to show that it lacks trustworthiness. But we think that it is reliable because of the circumstances under which it was obtained, what it actually has in it, and the fact that the sheriff then verified that he talked to the deputy and confirmed that it was accurate. And that testimony was given, wasn't objected to, didn't ask for any limiting instruction regarding that testimony, didn't ask the court to instruct the jury to disregard it because it wasn't proper. That's all part of the record that, as it stands, and that's all something that was legitimate. I mean, the judge didn't ask the jury to disregard that. So under those circumstances, we think that there's more than enough evidence present that a judge could say, under these circumstances, this has enough trustworthiness to admit it. So we believe that the standard clearly is an abuse of discretion, that Judge Gienapp did not abuse his discretion in admitting this evidence, that there are thousands of cases being tried out there all the time, and certainly a judicial mind, in view of the law and circumstances, could reach the same conclusion in a case like this. Therefore, we ask that you uphold the jury verdict.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Knight. Mr. Von Wald, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Von Wald, maybe just to start this off, could you address the comment made by counsel that even if this was error to admit this, it was not prejudicial, especially as to the negligence count?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue in this case, as it was developed before the jury, was who precipitated this altercation. And whether it was tried on an assault theory or a negligence theory really didn't make any difference, because the sheriff's report established who started the altercation for the jury. It was the official version. It was the version in Grant County. And so whether it was tried on a negligence theory or an assault theory or some other theory doesn't make any difference. This report came in and it was punishing. It was the sheriff of Grant County, his sworn testimony that he believed that what was in that report that had been prepared by a deputy that at one point he said he hadn't talked to, that this was the official version of it. It was the death knell. It was a shot through the heart. And counsel, when that happens at a trial, if your case hasn't wilted and died on the vine, it would be miraculous. It was that important. And it's illustrated again. It was illustrated to be that important, and it was substantive evidence. It came in. They intended it to come in as substantive evidence because it was going. The intention was to be offered with the sheriff. The report went right to the jury. Now, even if it had been impeachment evidence, I believe that the rule would be the same. But in this particular case, it came in as substantive evidence. And for the jury to find, for my clients, they were in a position that they would have to reject the official version of the incident as prepared by the Grant County Sheriff.
You know, I got to ask you about that.
Sure.
If it had come in when it was first offered, in the plaintiff's case, it would have been substantive evidence. But the judge refused it at that point. And it only came in after you put your case on and the plaintiff was cross-examining your witness's version of what happened. So that's not using it as substantive evidence at that point. Maybe that was their intent to start off with, but the way it actually came in was different, wasn't it?
Well, you know, I don't believe so. And of course, we know the differences between substantive evidence and impeachment evidence, but the fact is that it came in there like a bomb. And whether you characterize it as impeachment evidence or we have disagreement about whether it was impeachment evidence or substantive evidence, the effect was the same. We had a report, we had testimony by a witness, this deputy sheriff who did not appear. We had testimony by a witness who was not subject to cross-examination. You know, if I were to take the stand and say that I was in peer and someone else took the stand and said, I talked to someone, they said he wasn't. How would I demonstrate through cross-examination that I was in fact in peer today? I would be without any means to do that. And of course, that's where we get to the due process considerations. And that's what this court has been concerned with before. That's where this court, wrote in Dubray, those very considerations about how these narratives and law enforcement reports are of such a nature that they do not fit within the public records, the business records exception. And in State versus Bainham made it very clear that they don't fall within the public records exception. For all of those reasons, Your Honors, again, I would respectfully submit that the trial court abused its discretion in ruling on the admissibility of this evidence, and that this case should be remanded to the Third Circuit for retrial.
All right. Mr. Van Wall, before you leave,
yes, Your Honor.
So I'm sure you're saying that just because of the nature of the report that it lacks trustworthiness?
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. I think that in my review of the Dubray case, the court was careful to point out that there may be parts of a law enforcement report that would be admissible as a business record. For example, when the time the call was made, when it was made, where it came from, the location of the incident, but not the narratives. The narrative part of these reports are an entirely different matter. And I think that's one of the teachings of this court in Dubray, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wall. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.